Good morning, everybody. Thank you so much for attending ZionMN's first physical conference since our March 2020 event that was actually here, believe it or not. We'd like to thank you all for adhering to the COVID protocols, including seated session viewing, tiered registration, and the temperature checks. And of course, we thank you so much for coming out to the conference. For additional information about IMN's coronavirus policies, please visit the Euromoney Event Shield on our website. Just a few quick announcements before we kick off the session. The Q&A will be using the Slido.com app. Information is right there. So please, instead of raising hands, we'll be using the app for the questions. We'll be in breakouts until lunch. After lunch, this will be we'll be using this as the single room. All are welcome to eat lunch with us and stay for the networking reception at 5:40. And all, of course, are welcome to attend tomorrow's sessions. You'll need to have your temperature checked at that time as well. Now I'd like to introduce the first panel. It's our long-term debt financing discussion, and it's going to be moderated by Rob Beardsley, the principal with the Lone Star Capital Group. Thank you all so much.
All right, thank you everybody for joining us today. This is the long-term debt financing panel, and we've got a good diversified panel with a couple owner-operators and agency and bridge lenders, so we can get both perspectives on what is happening today. So first off, I just want to open it up and we'll get into a very popular topic, which is bad debt, and hear from first the lenders just on what they're seeing and how, you know, what wiggle room they have to underwrite bad debt if it's recent but stabilizing into the future.
Sure. I don't know if this is working. Everyone good? I'm Colin Cross with Lument. Lument, like Rob said, is an agency and bridge and HUD lender nationwide. We are focused on both small balance lending as well as large conventional transactions, upwards of, you know, 100, 200 million. So happy to be here today. As it relates to bad debt, to the question, what I'll say is that it has definitely been something that we've seen the agencies and our own credit committees be very conscious of here, especially in the last couple of months. I feel like every single time we get a brand new deal in, the most important thing that we ask for besides your T12 operating statements and your rent rolls is let's see an age receivables report and see what those delinquencies look like 30, 60, 90 plus days. Because through everything that happened in the last year, depending on how the property managers and operators run their statements, you may have some bad debts that are lingering out there that haven't been written off yet and maybe waiting to get some local municipality rental assistance. And so as part of that, the agencies just want to know what that looks like and whether there might be an availability for them to have to mark some of those bad debts now when they're doing their current upfront underwriting, or if they think there's going to be some rental assistance that's going to be coming into place and those tenants may be able to catch up. So definitely something that we've been seeing, you know, paying a lot more attention to here recently.
Yeah, I'm Edward Gray of Greystone. You know, we're a nationwide lender, Fannie, Freddie, HUD, CMBS. Colin gave a great answer there. You know, the one thing I would add to it is it's not cookie cutter. You know, we do want to hear what the story is behind it. You know, are they improving? You know, just what do the delinquencies look like? One of the, you know, funnier things, if that's the right word, but we find that, you know, some owners may own two properties in the same submarket, and one property has just been riddled with bad debt and the other is untouched. It's been very weird to us how, you know, there was necessarily no rhyme or reason by which properties took, you know, bad hits on bad debt and others moved through kind of unscathed. And so the story matters a lot. And, you know, again, share the story early if you're a lender. We don't want to find out later.
Bruce? All right, normally we do intros on these things. So I'm Bruce Fraser, managing partner of Elkhorn Capital Partners. We are owner operators of a sizable workforce housing portfolio in the South and Midwest. We are we target distressed situations where strategic capex or expertise in management can turn around a situation. I think that we look at the market a little bit differently than others. I ran a successful hedge fund for over a decade, and a number of years ago made the decision to focus based on our outlook on hard assets, specifically multifamily. I think that if things continue to play out as we anticipate, then long-term debt structures are going to be critical to the success of projects. But specifically diving into bad debt, yeah, again, we think about things differently than most people. I know lenders, it scares them. For us, it's a potential opportunity. We closed a 260 unit on Monday that I won't say it's the driver of our investment thesis, but a portion of the thesis of the upside was that they had $250,000 of bad debt on the sheets. And the former owner didn't know how to deal with that. They were self-managing, and it was the only asset they had in the state. They didn't know about the programs available. So we looked at that salivating, hoping they did not start learning on their own while we were under contract. And what we know from having a lot of assets in the area was that there are CARES Act funded programs available to these people that need rental assistance. And the first day mandate of my team was to go in there, file paperwork on every single delinquent party, because we'll be able to collect, hopefully, largely most of that delinquent balance. And it wasn't part of our return profile, but it is something that we had our eye on as potential upside. And so, I think we're on our second day now, and we've already have over $30,000 coming in this week on that bad debt that the former owner didn't know how to collect. And so, we think it's strategic value, but we understand the lender's traditional perspective of being hesitant and concerned about the situation. But the reality is, we just went through a global pandemic, right? Things are not normal. So you can't look at a delinquency situation in our view as normal. Now in a class A or B property, sure, I think in my perspective that would be more alarming, because those people should be able to work from home. And so why is there an ongoing bad debt issue situation there? But on workforce housing or C-class properties, these are people that are laborers, they're workers, they're not able just to open their laptop and sit in their jammies at home and continue to work. And so there was a lot of disruption in that space, and our portfolio saw it to varying degrees. Some were unaffected completely, but some had an impact, and it was highly correlated to the socioeconomic status of the tenant base. But again, we look at bad debt differently. It is something to keep your eye on, because you don't want to have to take over. Most people don't want to have to take over an asset like we just did and immediately file 50 eviction notices. But sometimes it takes that to make money.
Hey, good morning. My name's Chihiro Kurokawa, Black River Equity Partners. I'm a little early in my career, done two deals, one value add, one distressed. But in terms of bad debt, what I would say is having an awesome property manager is really critical, and just having them really aggressively filling out the paperwork, which is no small feat. It's a lot of administrative burden, but having a property manager and a site manager who's really on top of that stuff and aggressively advocating for the tenant in order to get them rental assistance is, I think, number one for us in our experience, especially in our distressed property, to limit the effect of bad debt.
So to flip it around, focusing on rent growth, obviously for long-term debt and long-term ownership, rent growth is a major component of the business plan. So how are both the owners and the lenders on the panel underwriting rent growth?
I'm happy to jump in. Since we focus on distressed situations, we're more focused on occupancy, because we'll often take over a 30% or 50% occupied property, and that's a much bigger dial than rent growth. So our investment thesis is rarely on buying the asset, putting a ton of money in, and boosting rents a couple $100s. I think that thesis right now, at least short term, possibly intermediate term, should be taken with a little bit more caution, just because the unemployment rates are still very high. We do anticipate some high inflation for an extended period, and we see that coming into wages as well. So there will be wage inflation that will help support rent growth. We just don't want to make our sole investment decision on that. So we model things just in line with CPI, 2%, even if we're going in and heavily investing in the property. I think that's, what are you seeing, Ed?
Yeah,
what are you guys modeling?
In all the long-term debt programs, it's based on, the in-place, what's happening now at the property. And so we're less focused on, the rent growth to pay us back. It's, more about the amortization, creating a spot where, whatever the exit is, year 10 or 12 or the property will pay back. So it's less about that. But I agree with Bruce. Inflation appears that it's here. How many things that we're paying for right now that you're in your own lives that gone up in price dramatically. As long as we have the wage growth, I anticipate seeing good rental growth for most properties. And it's kind of a perfect storm right now in the multifamily space to do more deals. It's a great time to be doing it.
Yep. Yeah. I'll just add on that that Ed's right that on the agency side, it's really an in-place situation. The place where the rent growth question kind of comes into play is when you're trying to get those years of interest only on the upfront, because that's where really Fannie and Freddie especially are taking a look at specific market by market, every single county, and seeing what the projected rents are, and they're updating those projections every quarter or so. And then whatever that specific market is dictating for rent growth helps support whether or not we believe the top line rent growth for our agency loan might be able to get out with a higher NOI in the future at the 10 or 12 year, 7 year maturity, and still support some years of interest only where you don't have that amortization going in there. So something to definitely talk to your lender about is hey, what are you showing that the rent growth is for this specific market, and how does that maybe affect the interest only that we can get?
Yeah, one thing to add there to help in working with lenders, while our financial models, we usually forecast a very low rate of growth on the rents. We to get the lenders comfortable, instead of just using what a lot of people do is just an average rental rate per unit and then applying some factor to it. Many times, first year they'll throw a 5% or 8% factor on top of rent growth, which is just not possible to do, because most people that are owners here know you're not going to have a full turnover the first month you buy, right? And so in order to get a 5 or 8% rent growth in 1 year, you have to actually be raising rents 20 or 30%. And so it's just unreasonable expectation. But what we will do, even though we have modest rent growth assumptions to get lenders comfortable in this still uncertain time, is we look at what's called mode rents. And so average, as you take them all and just average them, it can be really skewed by a couple high numbers or a couple low numbers. We'll take a look at the distribution of where all the rents are and how many are at different rental rates for each unit type. And so if we see a concentration, let's say they're 31 bedroom, 600 square foot units, but let's say 15 of them are at a higher rental rate, irrespective of what the average shows, we know that that's a market clearing rate because there are a lot of people already paying it. And so we'll use that analysis for our own purposes, but also show that to lenders and say, look, we know that we're going to get these rents because we're already getting these rents. And so there's really no leap of faith there.
I like one of your earlier points, Bruce, on distress, which is, what I've got a pending acquisition that's 40% occupied right now. But theoretically, without raising rents a dollar, I can get increased revenue, right, by 150%. To get the 100% occupancy. So I like having an element of control over the operations and increasing the revenues dramatically as opposed to depending on market forces. So on that particular acquisition, my underwriting is 2% rent growth. So I can not be aggressive on rent growth assumptions by targeting a certain type of asset.
Right, yeah, you don't need it.
So Ed, when we talked a few weeks ago in preparation for this panel, there were some interesting updates coming out of the agencies as far as reserves and also we might have discussed the HUD 3-year rule changes. So what are the latest updates coming out of the agencies?
I'll do HUD real quick. And HUD recently has changed its rules. It used to have to, from the time you brought a deal, if your certificate of occupancy used to wait 3 years before you could bring a deal to HUD if it wasn't financed via HUD for the construction. As the Davis-Bacon Wage Act stuff, a year ago they changed that so you could bring a deal in directly from certificate of occupancy for a HUD loan. And so, that's created a demand for additional HUD loans. At the same time, in HUD loans, there's two numbers you care about. There's your interest rate and your MIP. There's the regular MIP and the green MIP. And in February, March, they recently changed the green MIP. And so HUD has had a huge wave of deals come in, which is slowing down the HUD process dramatically. And we're expecting that wave to clear, October, November-ish. And, HUD will be something more resembles normal operations. So like right now, if you submit a deal to HUD, it may sit at HUD untouched, you know, for 90 days with no one doing anything on it, which is drives a borrower nuts when you're like, yeah, man, you know, it's sitting there for 90 days. Like, you know, we often have a hard time because people, you know, we submit a deal to Freddie and it sits for 12 days. You're like, yeah, it's just there. And so, you know, we think that HUD will be a great opportunity for a lot of people going forward that, you know, historically, you know, weren't HUD borrowers. Then, you know, switching to the agency side, you know, Fannie and Freddie are, you know, feel to be pleasantly surprised by how their portfolios have performed through COVID. You know, we're seeing relaxation of the reserves. You know, Fannie's giving them up, Freddie's giving them up. You know, in the last, you know, 2 weeks, you know, we started sending back COVID reserves on the Fannie side to borrowers. You know, in last week's, you know, federal holiday happening on one day's notice, that definitely threw us for a little bit of a loop because we had a bunch of wires we're supposed to go out and borrowers. I told we're getting money. And I'm like, you know, it happened on a day's notice. You'll get paid on Monday. And so it feels like, you know, generally, you know, Fannie, Freddie, HUD, I mean, even our CMBS side, everyone is, you know, bullish on what's coming and, you know, relaxing and looking to get back to something that resembles more business as usual. You know, the stories, as always, still matter. And it's just you make sure that, you know, you're working with your lender and shaping the story to get the best result possible.
Colin? Yeah, I'll just add that, you know, we submitted a HUD deal in March just before they changed. They actually changed part of their map guide back in March. And so there was a big glut of wave of loans that were going in to try to beat that guide change. I just got an update this past week that it's sitting in the queue right now and it's not expected to be picked up by anybody until August. So you're talking about maybe the longer than 90 days right now in specific HUD offices. So obviously the name of the game with HUD forever has always been to be patient, because if you're gonna get that up to 85% you know, leverage and you're gonna get that 117 cover and a rate that's probably 50 basis points inside of where the agencies even are right now, you know that you've got to go through a little bit of the hurry up and wait situation. So, but it's definitely been something that for conventional and seniors multifamily, the three-year rule being gone has definitely piqued the interest of the HUD side. And talk about, I mean, that's your long-term, you know, the longest of long-term debt options that are out there, because they've got the 30 to 40 year amortization periods and terms that they can open up after about 10 years in terms of the prepay penalties winding itself down. So really becomes a great loan to have if you can deal with the process up front.
Yeah, I mean, as an owner-operator, I would just say, I mean, it's very alluring, HUD is. You look at the 35-year amort potential, the lower interest rate, higher leverage, so it can really make a situation look strong. We've just never been able to, every time I dig into it and talk to HUD or HUD people, I just never can get over it. I mean, literally, a HUD desk told me last month when we were looking at it again, like, well, you have to suspend all common sense if you're going to work with HUD. I'm like, well, I'm not sure I can do that. And I think Ed knows I'm probably not patient enough to work with HUD. So I like to get things done. But, you know, one of the things that attracts people to it is the low rate. It is clearly lower than other alternatives out there in most cases. But when you dig into it, there is the MIP, or what most people that have dealt with on their residential homes, PMI, it's basically mortgage insurance that is added on top of that rate, which does reduce the spread between HUD and Freddie or something else. There still is a difference, but it's not quite the magnitude that people think. In just the annual inspections, where they can dream up whatever they want to, because they look at it differently than some of the lenders will. Most lenders come and inspect the property, make sure everything, the collateral's, you know, what they expect it to be, and that there aren't any health safety issues or anything like that. HUD will look out for the next 10 years and say, well, you know, we think in year 8, you're gonna need to replace your roof. We think you're gonna need to replace 50 ACs. So we'll start accruing for that now. And so it can be really restrictive on your cash flows, even though you have the lower interest rate. So that's something to be careful of.
So speaking of interest rates, on the long-term debt side, you also, Bruce, mentioned inflation coming. So between fixed versus floating, what are the strategies that you guys are looking at today for borrowing long term?
Yeah, I mean, it's a little bit counterintuitive, but there are some situations where we're actually borrowing short term to get into a better long term situation. We have an asset we took over, and it was 65% occupied. This was during COVID, and now it's 95% on higher rents, which is great. but it isn't seasoned. You know, we've had it less than a year, and so Ed could probably get it done, but we could probably get a better deal if we let it season another year, and they don't have to worry about that look back, and they aren't making exceptions in their view to let it happen. And so we went to an insurance co to do a short-term low-cost bridge. It's not your traditional bridge because it's real low loan to value at this point, but we're going to sit on that for about a year and then probably take it to Ed's team or somebody else's team to get us the best rate possible. So, you know, we are very concerned about long-term inflation. In fact, I think the macroeconomic context, what's going on in the world with currency, I don't want to geek out, but currency debasement, the devaluation of the dollar, there's a massive demand for hard assets. It just has a store of value, if nothing else. We do think that, we don't really believe that the Fed's going to aggressively raise rates, but our concern is that the market will raise rates on the Fed because, frankly, they're a debtor that can't pay back the debt. And so that's a concern to us, but we don't think that break's going to happen imminently. And so we're willing to still be doing bridges because a lot of our acquisitions, like I said, are distressed. We have to buy on bridge because it's not stabilized. We'll go in and do that, and then as quickly as we can, we'll put it on nice long-term debt.
So the deal you mentioned, will you take it out to fixed or floating rate long-term debt?
Oh, we're only do fixed rate.
Only fixed rate.
Only fixed. I'm super conservative. I just don't like the variable. And so with our view multiple years out, if we have a 10-year note or something, we don't want to take that interest rate risk.
Yeah, I mean, fixed versus float, it's really a business plan conversation. You know, exactly what Bruce said. If you have an asset that you will improve greatly, you know, over the next 24 months, you put it on, you know, 24-month, you know, on a floater and then refinance it, you know, 24 months from now, you know, into putting it into your long-term debt, assuming that you want to be a long-term holder or you sell it, you know. The idea, and I know people do it, is, you know, I'm going to put a 10-year floater on the property and you let it sit for 10 years. That just seems, you know, something you've been rewarded for the last 10 years, but just not a good idea for future planning. It, you know, at some point, you know, if the, you know, rates revert, it puts you in a bad spot. It's just, it's hard to say that I'm planning for the future, you know, 30 days at a time.
Yeah. If agency will do a hybrid, you can do a 5, 7, or 10-year hybrid, I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think they'll do a 5-year, yeah. Which where it's fixed for that first period of time, 7 years, let's say, and then they're another, I guess it's usually a 20-year term total.
Yeah. Right?
So 20-year term total, so the first 7 years or 10 years might be fixed. After that, it floats, but there are rules around how much it can increase per year. So what it allows you to do, it's a nice option in our view, and we just did it not that long ago, but it allows us to, you know, on a normal note, you have about a 60-day window in order to refinance. You know, when your 10-year period's up, you better hope rates are where you want them to be in order to lock in. Or rates or reserves or who knows what's going on. You know, there might be a pandemic or something.
Yeah, I mean, the Freddie small balance, you know, hybrids are an absolutely fantastic loan, and yeah. It gives you that safety net of, you know, a great recession, a COVID happening. You can just chill for a year, chill for 2 years.
Gives you more control of your time.
Yeah, it's you know, it's one of the loans I think more people should look into hitting. You know, somehow people see the 20-year term, not realizing the, you know, the prepayment penalty basically goes away, you know, after the, you know, fixed rate portion is done. That one gives you a lot of flexibility, with a lot of built-in protections that, you know, again, we were talking about something, you know, 10 years from now, you want that protection just in case you need it. You know, it basically no optionality costs. I mean, it's, you know, generally, yeah. A free add-on.
And truly, I mean, sometimes there's some basis, it's a few basis points higher to get that one versus a normal one. But more recently, with the term structure the way it is, it was actually cheaper to get one that gave you the flexibility than one that just had a hard stop.
Yep. And those are all of a small balance loan size. So they're really those 1 to 7.5 million loans. You start getting above the 7.5 million range, you really have to decide whether you're going to do a lockout period that's a 1 year or 2 year lockout, and then it gets a 1% prepay thereafter on the floater versus your longer term yield maintenance or defeasance. As Ed said earlier, it's really a business plan play, plain and simple. I mean, I'm sure there's plenty of folks in this room who, you know, looked at where things have been in the last couple of years and have bought some great assets and are like, great, I'm going to go sell this thing right now. And the values are up. And then you go and ask your lender what their prepay penalty is on the yield maintenance from the last couple of years. And you've still got 7 years left on a, you know, a 10 or a 12 year deal. And the number is astronomical. So it really is a question of if you want to be that long-term holder, if you want to have that cash flow really being, you know, what your main plan is, then you're never going to get anything better than, you know, your 10 and 12 year long-term fixed rate stuff with the agencies or life cos if you're going a little bit on the lower leverage side. But those arms, especially when you get above the 7.5 million range, you can always convert those straight from the ARM into a fixed rate execution at that time as well. You can work with your lender and with Freddie Mac or Fannie Mae to do that at any point as well. So either you refinance out of it, either you sell it and you've got that flexible prepay, or you can convert it to a fixed at some point as well. So it definitely just kind of depends on what your plan is.
Yeah, let me follow up on a couple points Colin just made. One, first of all, for those that haven't experienced it yet, lockout means truly you can't pay off the note, you cannot sell. And so take that into account in your business plan. It's not that there's a prepayment penalty, you just can't do it. And so it protects the lender because they have to go to a lot of time and expense to get these loans done on their side, and they want to make sure that they recoup their enough interest to cover themselves as well. But I can't underscore enough what he said about aligning your business plan with the debt structure. We see it over and over. New people, they goal seek to the lowest interest rate, which typically is yield maintenance or maybe CMBS or something else. And it's just a terrible mistake because of the yield maintenance. Now, we're ex-hedge fund people. We're very quantitative. We have our finger on the pulse of what's going on in the public market still very well, and the Fed and everything else. You know, we had a couple early deals that we did yield maintenance on because Powell was saying rates were going up, and they were going up. Well, you know, guess what? Things change within a 10-year window, and, you know, went the other way. Now rates are lower. And so I think it's, you know, most people would guess that rates are going up from here. But frankly, who the hell knows? You know, and it's a third of the industrialized world has negative interest rates right now. Can I promise that we won't have negative interest rates in the next 10 years? I can't. So we just will not. It's an absolute policy. We will not do yield maintenance. You know, a soft step down is the way we prefer to go. So you know exactly what your exposure is if you do want to sell unexpectedly. You know, because there are those assets. You have something like, oh, we're going to own this forever. We're on this long term. Well, you know what? Someone knocks on the door and offers you something crazy. Sometimes the right thing to do is to take it.
There's value in certainty,
right? For sure.
I mean, yeah. On Bruce's point about you step down prepays today, you know, interest rates are so low that even if you pay the extra 40 basis points or whatever on a conventional deal, or the 20 basis points on a small balance deal for the step down prepay, I mean, the rates are still so comically low that it's a great deal even paying extra. And that's, you know, again, it's one of those things you have the conversation, what is your business plan? You know, don't get blinded by the lowest rate. You know, focus on your business plan. And, you know, if you have a deal with a step down prepayment, you know, you brought it in on day one at 80%, and because you created a ton of value, you know, the loan's now at 65%, you know, do you recap that property? Or do you redo your loan, maintaining your lower loan balance and getting a lower, because you're lower LTV? I mean, there's lots of things that can happen that, you know, again, with today's low interest rates, paying extra for the step down can be a fantastic thing for many people.
Colin, are you saying the same thing as far as borrowers seeking the step down?
Yeah, and it really honestly depends on, I mean, again, we're talking about long-term agency and HUD and CMBS financing. I think it's very hard-pressed in the acquisitions markets right now to see the property prices that are actually trading matching up with the collections and the rental NOI that's actually happening at the property. So if that deal actually works out on the acquisition side where you've got the NOI that works for an 80 or 75% agency loan, then you've got obviously a little bit more flexibility to talk about doing, you know, a 10-year loan that maybe has a 5 or 7-year yield maintenance period that matches up more with your business plan. And you add that 20 or 30 basis points on something like that for like a Fannie Mae execution. But if that's not, once you start beefing that rate up a little bit more, most of the time, all of the deals that we're seeing right now are all debt service coverage constrained. So that higher rate means that the lower amount of loan dollars that you're able to get, which means your leverage is going to be pushed down. So then it really matches up with, okay, maybe I have to go and raise more equity. Maybe I need to go and talk about a mezz structure or some other structure to kind of get that leverage point up to what you were expecting. So it kind of, again, really deal by deal really depends on kind of how your individual asset and your individual business plan kind of shakes out.
Jared, coming over to you, I know you obviously have some distress and bridge type plays. What are you looking at as far as interest rates and structuring that loan?
What rates am I paying?
Sure.
So we have a 248-unit formerly distressed property we acquired in September of 2019. So we're at about 20 months, and that was L plus 415, if I remember correctly. You know, we bought a rate cap because it was required, but we've never, LIBOR's never exceeded the floor. So it's effectively been a fixed rate loan thus far.
And do you plan on taking out these bridge loans into long-term debt? And if so, fixed or floating?
That's TBD right now. We're actually, we're in a good place. It took a little while, you know, the COVID really hit us pretty hard. This is definitely workforce housing, but we really turned a corner January this year and have been setting revenue records practically every month. Like 14 out of the last 15 months we've set revenue records. So I'm definitely content with the prospect of holding and then refinancing into perm or potentially selling before our term runs.
Yeah, I mean, there can be a real strategy. I mean, if you're short term, if you're planning to go in, fix something that's distressed and turn it around and then take it to market, if that is your business plan, there's a real reason to just keep it on bridge the whole time. I don't know why you would go to the expense of refining to long-term note, pay all those fees, lockups, everything else, and then you have difficulty or reducing your partner returns. So that doesn't always make sense. I mean, you know, whether you're working with a long-term lender, because even if you're going to Freddie, you know, you can work with people that work directly with Freddie, or the servicer relationship of the banks that you work with can vary pretty dramatically, even though it's ultimately still Freddie paper. And same, certainly, it's probably even more noticeable on the bridge front how different they all are and what they like, what they don't like. You know, we are getting more and more serious about vetting lenders that we work with up front. Cover your ears. It is somewhat of a commodity. I mean, it is paper, and as long as the terms match up, but it doesn't always make sense to go with the person with the best terms, which, you know, everybody's like, oh, no, but I mean, that's true. We had a situation where we almost lost a deal. The one that we closed on Monday, it was a bridge situation. We bought it on bridge. Some things that were not on the term sheet, all of a sudden, you know, when we did our kickoff call, they were things that were just clear. We, as a fiduciary, we just absolutely could not accept. And that cost us about 3 weeks of delay, and because we had to pick another lender to go with. And, you know, they went to extraordinary measures to get it done in less than 3 weeks, which is shocking. But the property value had increased dramatically, and the seller was not willing to give us even a day of extension because they no longer wanted to sell. And so, you know, pre-vetting your lenders, knowing those people well, spend some time with them, make sure you understand what they're looking for and things that might be surprises to them that they don't want and would mess up a deal. Make sure you know that before you go in. Have those conversations ahead of time. In this case, it would have cost us millions of dollars. This property value has already increased, and we wouldn't have been able to get it done.
And as a newer borrower, what I would say is talk to people who have borrowed from the lender or lenders you're considering, because I can't say enough about servicing and how amazing or terrible that can make your experience in trying to manage an asset. There's nothing that hurts more, not hurts, but bothers you more than having a ton of cash locked up in escrow and you're just pulling your hair out trying to deploy that capital in the way that you see is best fit for the operation of your asset, but you're running into issues from a servicing standpoint. So I echo you 100%. Bruce, vet your lenders.
What are specific questions that a borrower can ask to try to tease out those things before it's too late?
Yeah, so to learn from my mistake, talk to people who have borrowed from that lender before, and you know, what was your servicing experience like? If you had to change your CapEx plan mid-flight, like, was that feasible, or did they stonewall you? How quickly were you getting your draws back? These
really
are
important.
Critical for your operations.
Draw on that a little bit so people explain, because not everybody here does distress, but if you're buying a distress situation deal and you have a heavy CapEx spend, or even if you're just doing a regular value add and increasing the unit's rental value, if they're very drawn out in their cycle and they're asking for tons of paperwork back and forth. I mean, once you've done it a few times, you know what a lender's going to want. But if you're providing that and there's still being a pain and drawing it out, it can take weeks or possibly even months. Well, that can delay your construction timeline, because a lot of the vendors want a prepayment of a portion up front before they start work or buy products, especially in this high inflationary period. You know, product costs have gone up 30% year to date, and so they don't want to commit without going and actually being able to buy it, and they're not going to buy it unless they have the money. And so very critical, can actually impair your business plan and your returns or blow your IRRs. Even if you get the same return, if it takes you an extra year to get it done, well, that messes you up.
Yeah, an interesting nuance about that point is if you do construction in-house, then you are the GC or the vendor that has to float the cost of the construction. So you can't lay it off on your vendor partners. And so now you are really up against cash management with the bank. So even more important to make sure that the lender has a smooth draw process.
Very important.
Do you guys want to touch on maybe some things that they didn't think to ask or should be asking?
Yeah, I mean, one of the simple ones is, you know, do you service your own loans? You know, many lenders sell their loan servicing off as a profit center, you know, whereas at Greystone, you know, we service our loans. And so, you know, if a borrower, whatever, have a problem with a Greystone loan, which never happens, they can just call their relationship manager and they're like, hey, Edward, I had a problem. And I'm like, oh, okay, you know, let me call over to servicing. And, you know, quickly things can get figured out when it's all in-house. Whereas when it's been sold off, you know, I don't have an ability to, you know, call, you know, not me, we do it in-house, but, you know, the lender then no longer has an ability to call their own servicing team. You know, it's some third-party vendor that doesn't care about, you know, their original relationship.
Yeah, and they're just looking at the docs at that point and saying, hey, there's a certain stip that we're supposed to hit here and they haven't hit it, so we're not going to give our draws out. And that's what it says on paper. That's same type of deal with Lument. We service our own loans as well, and that's the most important thing you can do is make sure you understand what the lender's ultimate goal. I mean, it's kind of strange to say that a lender has a business plan as well, but I know Ed at Greystone and Lument, same type of thing. Ultimately, we're trying to make sure that the loans that we do on the bridge are getting to that long-term financing option down the road, because that's what we do as kind of, you know, our bread and butter business. And so if it's a situation that happens midstream, like Jahira was talking about, where CapEx plans change, or, you know, things like what happened in the last year, COVID, hey, we can't get into units. We can't upgrade units right now because we can't get in them right now. That's where you actually having that relationship with the lender and the servicer to say, hey, we haven't hit all of our numbers yet, or we haven't been able to hit all of the number of units we were going to turn at this point. Let's still work out a plan here that gets us to ultimately the end of that bridge term. And if we need to go through extension processes, we discuss that, but it's more of a partnership with your lender than it really is an adversarial, you know, got to make sure you hit the specific specs, or else, you know, they're going to come back and hold all your cash. So definitely most important thing is know your lender, have those discussions up front, and make sure that you guys are all aligned on what your plan is.
Yeah, I mean, the servicer piece is so important to us. We had a really bad experience with the servicer. You know, it wasn't due to debt service or anything like that. We were fine on that. It was they were difficult with everything. And it was such a negative experience that we had looked at an acquisition. I remembered it was an assumption broker. The deal fell out because we hadn't won on the deal. Called me back to say it was available again. I said, remind me who the servicer was. And they told me, I'm like, yeah, as the saying goes, I'm just not ready yet. And it's been, I think, 3 years or so, and I'm still not ready. I'm like, I just can't do it. So we passed on the deal that we really liked just because of the servicer on the deal, because the note had to be assumed. We just couldn't add that frustration to our lives.
So it looks like we're running out of time here. Just as a reminder, if you have questions, you can submit them at Slido, and we'll be able to answer them within the next few minutes. If there are no questions, we can just open it up.
How do we know if there are questions?
Where are
you? You don't have any questions?
I said, how do you know if there are questions?
I don't know.
Right
there. Yeah.
Are you willing to share who the servicer was?
No.
I'd rather not do that.
Yeah.
Catch me some in private.
Yeah.
I think David's heard the story probably, but I don't know.
Any other questions?
Edward, you mentioned you're talking about HUD and case space, and I don't remember who I heard this from, and it may be completely off. Is there something the worst with Davis Bacon and agency, like, where there's going to be requirements agency lending and Davis Bacon wages. I'd heard somebody, and I hadn't had a chance to even look it up. I mean, have you heard anything like that? Because that'd be a game changer.
I have not heard that, Colin.
No.
Okay. No.
Yeah.
It can be completely wrong. Somebody had said something, and keep me in the look
at
that.
Yeah.
I came in a little late to the meeting, so I don't know if this was addressed or not, but have most agencies and lenders dropped COVID-19 reserve requirements? Is that still being expected on?
Yes. Yeah, so Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac on their large balance executions have dropped COVID reserves on pretty much every asset type except for seniors and student, I believe. They're still putting those in place there. The small balance loans still have some of that in place, I believe, at this point, but they're working on getting all of those removed here soon. Fannie Mae has already started, as Ed mentioned earlier, started reimbursing clients with active Fannie Mae deals with those COVID reserves. Freddie is apparently working on that right now to start releasing those back to the borrower. So it is winding down, if not almost all the way there at this point.
Awesome. What about HUD? Is that also dropped?
I actually haven't heard about HUD's reserves.
Yeah, I mean, I don't have any HUD loans that are at the point where that would be an issue.
Yeah.
Mine are all stuck in.
HUD's going to have
everyone's in stuck in their queue right now. Yeah, so we don't know. Yeah.
HUD will most certainly have a lot of reserves. They may not be for COVID.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, you get the loan made first.
All right, well, if there are no further questions, thank you very much for joining us. Please give a hand to this wonderful panel.